Thanks to everyone for coming. I'm going to start off with something that I'm really excited about, and I work on non-local games, which has a large application in quantum computing and quantum foundations of physics and understanding quantum correlations. But I'd like to tell you today about something called compiled games. So this is a new notion of non-local games, and I think my goal today is to tell you some results and to tell you about what those are. So this is based on some work that's on the archive with a lot of people. We were doing two projects, and we came to some similar results, and so we kind of combined into this large project. So the main topic of this work is on non-local games. So let's just get on the same page here and remind ourselves what a non-local game is. So in a non-local game, we allow two parties interacting with a classical verifier to share some entangled resource. So here, we can think of this as some finite-dimensional quantum state that's shared between the two parties who are spatially separated. And this is a key point that I'm going to come back to over and over again. And in this game, a referee samples questions, X and Y, from a distribution. They send one to Alice, typically player one, and Bob, player two. And these provers or players respond with answers, outputs to these questions. And their goal is to satisfy some sort of winning predicate, which are like some rules of some game. Maybe they're trying to color some graph, or they're trying to come up with a solution to a linear system, or something like that. And the referee just checks if they win or lose the game, and the goal of these players is to win the game. So they're allowed to predetermine a strategy before the game begins, but of course they have no information about the questions they're going to get ahead of time. So they may or may not be able to win. There might be settings where they can win all the time, but we're interested in the setting where, in addition to just that problem, they have this additional resource, and we're trying to find out how powerful that adding entanglement or adding quantum resources is. And non-local games have been really very kind of fruitful endeavor. They've allowed us to witness and exhibit quantum correlations, non-contextuality. They've been really important in developing protocols and techniques for device-independent applications, such as quantum key distribution, delegated quantum computing, certifying entanglement. So these are some of the killer applications of non-local games. And recently, too, in understanding the complexity theoretic aspects of multi-interactive proof systems. So in quantum computer science or that area, we now know that the power of proof of this protocol is much more powerful than if we just had classical provers. That's what MIP is. So this, what you can decide with this is much bigger than what you can decide with that. So it kind of says something about the nature of entanglement. But are these really the best model for some of these applications I've mentioned, in particular, delegated quantum computation, verification of entanglement, proof of quantumness? How do we actually ensure that a device, if we're a classical verifier and we're interacting with a quantum prover, how do we actually ensure that they're spatially separated? Because that was kind of the key assumption. We needed to leverage quantum mechanics. We had to have two parties in all these settings. But if I'm a classical verifier and I'm interacting with a quantum device in the cloud, at another lab, how do I know that their qubits aren't, close together? And how do I know this device isn't communicating? And so it's quite unnatural in a lot of models for these protocols or cryptographic settings and schemes. We'd much rather like this setting to be like this, where we have a classical verifier and a quantum prover. But this has its own challenges, to kind of develop. If starting with this model, we have the same challenges as we did in the other model. It's quite difficult to verify quantum provers in this setting. So one approach is to wonder, could we remove or replace this spatial assumption with something else and still get, the benefits and boons that we have from all these theoretical results in the context of Bell scenarios, non-local games, quantum correlations. And the idea is, actually goes back to some ideas in classical computer science, and it's kind of to simulate these separations with cryptography. And so quite recently, some authors, up here, they developed an idea for compiling a non-local game. And this was comes from an idea in classical computer science of compiling a MIP protocol. And the gist of it is, we'll get into the details later, but they give a protocol that takes a two-prover game, or two players, to a single prover game. So this is now in the setting that we kind of wanted for our applications. And in particular, the important value, so the classical value of the game, of the compiled game, is kind of preserved. So remember, the classical value is the maximum winning probability amongst all classical strategies for that game. And I'll give those definitions in a bit. I just kind of want to get the basics out of the way first, or the kind of headline. In addition, they showed that if you have a quantum strategy for the original game, then that quantum strategy can be implemented in the compiled setting. So you can always do at least as well in the compiled setting as you could in the kind of two-prover spatial setting. And that's really important. But they left open this question of, well, you know, could you do any, could you do better? Like, is it possible that there are strategies, quantum strategies, in the compiled setting that do better than in the kind of two-prover setting? And this is something you want to rule out, because you might be concerned that this device might somehow be kind of more powerful in some sense than we allowed in the spatial model. Okay. And so the result that I'm kind of point out here with all these authors was that we kind of took a first step in showing something interesting about this, and that's for a very nice, simple class of games called XOR games that basically the quantum value is preserved for these things. And these are the only ones we kind of know so far, so there's a lot still open. Okay. So that's kind of the introductory part of my talk. So now I'd like to, for the rest of the talk, talk a little bit more about what values are for non-local games for those who aren't sure of the definitions. And then I want to take a brief interlude into quantum homomorphic encryption, because that's what makes this KLVY compiler work. So I want to tell you a little bit about that, and then once we have that under our belt, we can talk about what the compilation procedure is, and I'll give you some more formal results, about that. So I mentioned non-local games before. Those values I talked about are simply winning probabilities. So if I have a quantum strategy S and I have a non-local game G, then the omega sub Q is the value that I can achieve over all quantum strategies. That's the probability of winning with a specific strategy, and the value is the supremum over all such strategies. So here, the strategy itself consists of a bipartite Hilbert space, measurements on that space, and states on that space as well. So this is actually quite a hard optimization to do, because you can allow larger and larger spaces. But we know that quantum correlations can all be kind of essentially modeled up to, you know, dilations and whatnot as projective measurements on some pure states like this. So we have these are kind of telling us, well, if I have a non-local game, what do the correlations look like? They look like this. And you may know, too, that we have many other types of values. So if I restrict my set of strategies to be classical, then I can do this and talk about the classical value. Of course, these quantum correlations generalize classical correlations. And it's exactly the ones where you have a kind of states that are separable here. But of course, we can have more general models of quantum commuting correlations and non-signaling correlations, and we're not going to talk about those so much, but just so you know, they're kind of out there. A game you might all be familiar with is the CHSH game. It's a very simple non-local game where the verifier samples questions X and Y from some distribution, and the players respond with bits. And all the verifier is doing in this case is checking if the parity of their bits is equal to the product of X and Y. And we can write down an expression for the expected winning probability, or the bias, this is the probability of winning minus probability of losing. It's a very convenient way of representing this here. And what's nice here is actually these are now no longer POVMs, but they're binary observables. They're just unitaries that have eigenvalues plus or minus one. And they're, you know, very nice to work with for these types of games. And this game has some remarkable properties which were used in kind of all those important applications I told you about. So first of all, we know that quantum provers or quantum players can win this game with probability 1/2 plus square root 2 over 4, so roughly 80.85. But no classical players can win with probability better than 3/4. So of course, this is a kind of a bell. This is, comes from the classic Bell violation, the CHSH inequality. But more remarkably, this game has some amazing properties. So in addition to these, you know, it demonstrating you know, a violation of classical probabilities, classical correlations. If a prover is playing, or players are they're playing the game and they're attaining a value close to 0.85, then we can show that the state they're using must actually be an EPR pair. So they have to have had an EPR pair. They couldn't have some other, well, they could have some other state, so this is all up to local isometries, but basically they had to have had an EPR pair somewhere within their system. And in addition, the observables that they're using have to be kind of these poly measurements as well. So this is a pretty amazing fact about this game, and it's used all over the place. So before we can talk about compiled games, I want to tell you a bit about quantum homomorphic encryption. This is kind of what makes the compilation kind of work. And it's a really amazing idea. So I imagine here I have my my classical device and my quantum prover. And in quantum homomorphic encryption, the verifier here has some message. So I have some text, some data here. And I take my key and I encrypt it in my magic envelope, my encrypted envelope. And I send it to this prover here, or this device here. And what's amazing is the prover can run a circuit on this encrypted message. So up here, they're running it on my encrypted message here. This is their fancy quantum algorithm up here. Because I'm a classical verifier, I can't do quantum algorithms, but they can. And remarkably, when I decrypt my message, I see that my text is now like this green text, which means that they've actually executed their quantum algorithm on my data that I sent them, but they never unlocked the data. It stayed locked the whole time. They never got the key. So this is a pretty amazing kind of thing. And it, you know, it's not even 20 years ago that these ideas were possible classically, and now kind of we know that they can be done kind of, well, in theory, with a quantum device as well. So like I mentioned, yeah, so the prover never actually, you know, has this key. So it's pretty cool. So we're going to use this idea to, for our quantum strategies and our provers. So a little bit more. So there's two guarantees you kind of need. And the first one is sort of the correctness of the homomorphic evaluation. So if a prover wants to run some quantum circuit, then the quantum homomorphic encryption scheme says that there is a method, there's another circuit that they can construct basically, such that it kind of, you know, acts correctly on the encrypted input. And secondly, the security guarantees of this scheme are that two messages that are encoded under the same key are essentially indistinguishable. And these schemes have been proposed recently by Mahadev, and they're all based on the hardness of LWE, the learning with errors problem, which we, to this day, I think still hope that it's gonna be post-quantum secure. So even a verifier that is quantum can't break this encryption scheme unless given enough time or some breakthrough in quantum algorithms. But I did mention, so because of this LWE assumption, I actually have to, in this case, restrict my prover to be QPT, or quantum polynomial time. And that's in the security parameter of the scheme. So every scheme has this security parameter, and I just need to ensure that my security parameter is, you know, big enough that I'm secure. And so I have to basically make this assumption about my prover. Otherwise, if I let it run forever, then it could, you know, have broken the scheme. Any questions about quantum homomorphic encryption? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to throw this.
So you said there exists a circuit C-hat.
Right.
So the prover has to already have, like, it depends on C. So I guess the C is fixed ahead of time, or is there like a canonical construction of C-hat from C?
Yeah, it's like a canonical construction. Like if I, the scheme has to be fixed ahead of time, so the scheme is fixed. The prover knows the scheme, but they don't know what the secret key is. But they don't need the secret key to construct this canonical circuit that they can run that will give the correct output.
Okay, so the client can also specify C at the same time as the
The client can specify C, but there's no guarantee in the quantum homomorphic encryption scheme that they would like run that.
Right.
You have to kind of allow, in this, we allow them to like run whatever they wanted.
Right. But if you trust, I mean, if they're
if
doing
you trust
it correctly,
them, yeah.
That's or the point. Or not even if you trust them, if they're doing it correctly, then like if the security is strong enough and you under security assumptions, then they should be able to receive like the C and also the data and construct C tilde without ever knowing. Like they can construct C tilde without knowing the key.
They can construct
C. Oh, sorry, TCI. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know if I'm going to return this or.
Yeah, maybe just hold on to it and pass it to someone else. So now that we have that homomorphic encryption, we'll see how it's used in the compiled games, and I think it'll be more illuminating in that case. So I showed you before, so this is the picture we all know and love about non-local games. And what this KLVY compiler does is it turns it into this picture on the right. So in the non-local game, the questions X and Y were sampled and sent to Alice and Bob. Kind of in one round. So we call this like, this is all happening in sort of one round. There's no, the first thing to notice is on this right-hand picture, I have these T's on the bottom and they represent like timestamps. And here there's no timestamps. This is kind of all happening, X is sent, the players make some measurements on their joint state and they return these sort of things. And it actually, because of the spatial separations here between the states, doesn't matter, like their measurement operators commute, so it doesn't matter who measures first, who measures last, it's the same. They can apply local unitaries on each side, but that won't change the probabilities. But so how a compiled game works is the questions are still sampled ahead of time. However, at the beginning of the procedure, the question to Alice or player one is encrypted under homomorphic encryption. So the prover in the first time step receives an encryption of the question. And their starting quantum state looks like this. They have some quantum state on their prover Hilbert space. Now, I ask them for a response. I say, well, make your measurement. And they can make their measurement, like they can employ a quantum strategy faithfully because they have the ability to perform this quantum homomorphic encryption. So this encryption is done under the scheme. So if they got, zero, like the zero question in CHSH, they can run their strategy, honestly, where they apply, they measure the Z observable. They just run that quantum circuit, and they return this message. And this will be some encrypted thing, but because of the correctness of the quantum homomorphic encryption, I'll get the correct output when they ran it. But the point is, they didn't really know what this X was. They just got some encrypted thing. And that's the sort of how the first kind of interaction works. So I've described kind of so far how this interaction's working, and this interaction is now happening in the first round. Now we're gonna talk about how we interact with Bob in the second round. So now there'll be a second round where the question Y then is now sent to the prover at a later time step. But now notice that the state has changed because the prover has made a measurement. So now, unlike in a non-local game, in the bipartite scenario, here this state actually is going to be somehow like measured and changed potentially by the first prover, or the prover's first time step. So this is the one of the big differences in compiled games versus regular nonlinear games. So now Bob computes his strategy homomorphically, or actually no. So because I've already kind of hidden the question to Alice using the homomorphic encryption, Bob, the prover can't really doesn't know what X is. So now I can just in the clear, so I don't even need to encrypt anymore. I can send Y input to the prover, and they can respond with B, their output to the game. Okay. So the big differences between these two things are I've gone from a two-player one round to a one-player two round. So there's this round structure. Before, there was sort of this tensor product of Hilbert spaces. The spaces were spatially separated. But now I've gotten rid of that assumption, which is kind of our goal. And now we just have this single prover Hilbert space. But I've lost this sort of simultaneous measurement notion, right? And now I have to really consider this kind of model of quantum mechanics where I have done these kind of sequential measurements. And there's a post-measurement state being acted on. In addition, because before they could apply just local unitaries, they couldn't really change their probabilities. But of course, now if Alice does some measurement, she could potentially run some unitary as well on her state and kind of do some manipulation to it before Bob gets it. And it's because her unitary is acting on the whole space, I have to account for that. And there's no runtime assumptions in the normal game, but now I have to restrict the runtime of the provers to be kind of polynomial in the security parameter. Okay. So what would the compiled CHSH game look like? Well, I would sample my bits as the same, but I would encrypt them under the encryption scheme, and I would then send the second one after decrypting. I would send the second bit to the prover, and instead of checking, I now just check this predicate instead. Okay. So the first question you might ask is, if I have some values, classical values, quantum values, so that remember those are the winning probabilities under classical strategies and quantum strategies for the non-local game here, what will that be for the compiled game? Will I be able to get any sort of relations between these two things? And the first thing that was done was KLVY in their paper, they showed that for any classical strategies, you have this property called completeness, meaning if you have a classical strategy that succeeds with a given probability, then there's a compiled strategy that it succeeds with at least that probability up to some negligible factor, right? And this is coming from the security guarantees of there might be some negligible wiggle room basically happening with the security assumptions. And the second property they showed is soundness against classical provers. So it means that no classical prover can win the compiled game much better than they could win the original game. So there's an upper bound on any value of the compiled game by some negligible factor again. So this is some really small number. And and this is the classical value of the game, the optimal one. So this is really good. This is what we want because we want to ensure we're showing maybe witnessing quantum behaviors, and if we went to this compiled setting and all of a sudden they had more power, then this would be bad. And they also showed that if you have a non-local game and you have a quantum strategy, that you still have this completeness parameter, or you still have this completeness property, whereby if you could win the non-local game with a quantum strategy, then you can always do at least as well in the compiled game. Basically, in the way you'd imagine, you basically run your quantum strategy like you would in the bipartite case under quantum homomorphic encryption. So I prepare a bipartite state I'm an honest prover, I prepare a bipartite state, and I run my circuit homomorphically on each side of this bipartition. But they weren't able to conclude the soundness. So, right, we'd be concerned that there could be a better compiled strategy than the kind of one I've described, where that's kind of shown from in Bell scenarios, in regular nonlinear games where there's a spatial separation. So this is, you know, if we want to, we kind of need to answer this question if we want to leverage all our results from nonlocal games into this setting where we've gotten a single prover. And, you know, to be honest, it's there's still a lot unknown about this question. But in one setting, we do know that the value is kind of preserved in the quantum case, and that's in the case of these XOR nonlocal games. So XOR nonlocal games are a family of nonlocal games that are really kind of, they're very simple, they're very nice. The questions are just indices from some list up to, you know, of size n and size m, and the answers are single bits. The rule predicates are all of this form, so there's basically, there's a matrix of X and Y's, and those a matrix of plus or minus one valued entries, and those kind of determine the game. They fully determine the game. Well, other than the distribution. So you can imagine there's a distribution on questions, and then you have some rule predicate, and this describes kind of all non-local all XOR games. So in particular, the CHSH game is an XOR game where you have N and M are equal to 2. And I think the predicate is just going to be, like, CXY is just equal to the product of X and Y. So it's like the matrix is just like, yeah. You just have like a 1 in the 1-1 entry and zeros everywhere else. And one thing about XOR games is all the quantum correlations, or at least all the quantum correlations that arise that we'd witness if we asked two provers to play a nonlocal game are characterized by some lovely theorems of Cyrilson back in the 80s. So Cyrilson was studying these types of Bell scenarios, and he gave these lovely algebraic characterizations of all the kind of correlations that could come up. And as a corollary to this work, it actually means that this is the bias, it's the probability of them winning minus the probability of losing. But to optimize the value, all you have to do is kind of optimize this quantity. And because of these results about XOR correlations and XOR games, it turns out that computing the value is actually, you know, fairly straightforward. We have a semi-definite program that computes the value, and we don't know about how to do this in any other kind of setting. So these correlations can actually be solved for efficiently. And this kind of simple nature of these kind of correlations is what allows us to kind of get at the results in this setting. So here's our main result is that basically you get soundness in this setting. And that means that if G is an XOR game and this T of G is the corresponding compiled game, then any quantum prover who's playing the compiled game, remember here they have to be running in quantum polynomial time in the security parameter of the encryption scheme, so that is a restriction here, but they can't do better than the best quantum strategy for the original XOR game, up to some negligible amounts. And our proof techniques involve using some of the sums of squares, which is a way to upper bound the value of nonlocal games. Typically, it upper bounds the commuting value, the quantum commuting value. But another consequence of Cyrilson's theorem is that basically the quantum commuting value and the quantum value and this so-called vector value are all the same in this case. So I'm not going to talk about how we kind of got to those results, but you can kind of see the paper. For details. In addition, we got some other results in the context of compiled XOR games. So our results didn't just apply to XOR games, but actually to parallel repeated XOR games as well. So if you parallel repeat, so that just means you play the game, you play like the game like k times in parallel, and this is a prominent example of that is the parallel repeated CHSH game. And this game actually has the property that if you, it's a test for if you parallel repeat n times, it's a test for n EPR pairs, meaning you can only do optimally in the game if you have kind of n EPR pairs around. So we showed that you can actually, that this game, the parallel repeated game, it kind of fell out of our work the way the proofs worked, that not only did it hold for XOR games, but parallel repeated XOR games. And another thing we obtained was, remember way back I told you that when you played CHS8, it had these remarkable properties that, in addition to, you know, showing a violation of classicality, we have that we have these so-called rigidity properties. So what that means is that the observables that the players used had a certain form. They looked like tensors of polys. And we recover what we call one-sided rigidity because in the compiled games, we seem to only be able to get our hands on rigidity of Bob's measurements, which are the ones that are performed, remember, in the clear, so they're unencrypted. Somehow these operations that are encrypted under the homomorphic encryption, like what Alice is actually doing in her strategy under encryption, we haven't been able to figure out how to get our hands on, you know, what those could look like in a kind of a adversarial setting where we don't assume they're being honest. We might worry they're being malicious and they're performing some other strategy. So we get some rigidity results about that. And we also have some results about if you wanted to compile the magic square. So you compile the magic square. Now there, the soundness is less of an issue because there's a perfect quantum strategy for this game. You can win with probability one if you have access to quantum correlations. And you know, so in the compiled game, there might be other strategies that could do really well, but you can't ever do better than probability one. So that's why the kind of asking a question of whether, you know, this question of soundness is less so interesting perhaps in this, when you have games that can be won with probability one. But of course, understanding the structure of the measurement operators and the states that give you those correlations, that's still kind of really interesting. And lastly, we obtained some what we call nice sums of squares certificates for XOR games. So you can kind of see the paper for how we kind of do this, but for those who know the world of sums of squares and how they're used in compiled game or in non-local games, we think we have some interesting results about that. So some of the open questions about compiled games, well, is obviously, you know, is the quantum value preserved for all non-local games? So we have it for XOR games, but what about other games? You know, there's lots of other games out there. These are a small family, and they're actually such a simple family, and it's quite possible that it's, you know, that it's not preserved. Finding a counterexample or more results in this area is of big interest. In particular, like if you wanted to do kind of like you wanted to compile the MIPSTAR protocol for all of RE, that relies on the quantum soundness of the so-called low degree test, and you could imagine trying to compile this low degree test. And you know, if you could show kind of some results in that area, then you might have some single prover kind of MIP star thing. I'm sure it would be quite interesting. So self-testing was this idea where if you obtain certain quantum correlations, then certain observables, certain states have to have been kind of used up to local isometries. And this self-testing is a really important ingredient in improving soundness for tons of quantum protocols in non-local games, but we sort of lack, it's not clear what self-testing is in this compiled setting because we have these sequential measurements and the setting itself is quite different. How the measurements and what the probabilities look like are quite different than what we had in the original setting. And so even understanding what self-testing in this framework is quite interesting. And in fact, like I mentioned, the sets of correlations that arise from this game are kind of bizarre. And kind of we show that for the XOR games, they're kind of the same. But more generally, for other scenarios and other games, they could be wildly different. So it's sort of a new set of correlations to kind of uncover and understand where they fall between quantum and non-signaling, potentially. And like I said, what are the kind of limitations of this game? We don't think that, I mean, can we compile all these games? And or if not, are there ones that we can't compile? These are all sort of interesting questions that we're kind of just at the forefront of starting to explore in this setting. But that's all I have for you, so thank you very much for your time. And I think we have a bit of time for questions.
So maybe we can start if we have questions here. Yes, there is a microphone in the wild there. Anyone here present? Yes, Ravi.
Thanks for the nice talk. So I had a question about the when you go to the one prover setting, in the so you mentioned that you can have in general global unitaries, right?
Yeah.
So I was wondering if the measurements are also can be global? Can they be global, or are they assumed to be on just one side of
this? Yeah, they're global. So like the POVM that the player is performing is a POVM over all ciphertexts.
Okay.
And so there's going to be a POVM over all alpha. Like the outcomes will be alpha, but they're going to be indexed by all the possible ciphertexts they receive, and it will be a POVM on the full. Like the prover has a full, like a single Hilbert space. There's no tensor factorization. Like they're acting on the full space.
You go to the so if I give you a quantum strategy on the two prover side.
Yeah.
Is there a simple recipe to write down the quantum strategy on the single prover side? Like, and do we know how things map? For example, the CHSH, the optimal strategy. How does that map to the?
Yeah. So that's exactly right. You basically the guarantees of the quantum homomorphic encryption, basically the correctness allows you to just run the strategy that you could run in the honest case. You just take that strategy and you literally run it through the compiler. So the honest prover would actually prepare a bipartite state.
Okay.
And they prepare a Hilbert space that looks like HA tensor HB, and they would homomorphically perform their measurements on their like half.
Okay.
And leave the other half for Bob to perform.
Okay, so that property is preserved under the
exactly. Yeah. So that's the completeness.
Okay.
So the completeness is preserved by the transformation. Yeah.
Okay. And sorry, can I ask one little? So you also said that the set of correlations, like what it looks like, is not clear in the single prover setting. But what about like the maybe just the classical set, like the Bell-Polytope? What does that go to in the?
Sorry. Is the. That,
like the Bell polytope, like in the
Bell polytope?
Yeah, just
so the quantum one?
The classical polytope, basically.
The classical one, yeah.
So, yeah. So yeah. Is it in that case, is it easy to see what it goes to if you?
Yeah, so I think essentially, like, I'm not sure, I mean, correlations in games are a little bit different, but because games can kind of only test extreme points of
yeah,
this polytope,
sure, yeah.
but the fact that you have completeness and soundness here kind of says that that these, for at least for XOR games, any classical polytope will be preserved. Sorry, this is for all games. Right, I'm not talking about, this theorem here says basically that the classical polytope is preserved under the compilation. But we don't know, one way you can ask is like, is the quantum, whatever the quantum set is that preserved? And that's unclear.
Okay, okay, thank you.
More questions around here? Yes.
Thank you for the talk. I just had a question about homomorphic encryption in the quantum setting. So of course, you need the prover to be, you know, sufficiently bounded, so you can't just decrypt everything, which would defeat the purpose. So you need it for security guarantees. But I know in classical homomorphic encryption, you can sort of relax the assumption of how powerful the prover or the evaluator is by assuming the underlying hard problem is sufficiently hard. Like LWE, for example, in regev encryption. Mm-hmm. And you can let the prover be like quasi-polynomial time or something. And I'm wondering if that's maybe also true in the quantum setting.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on those topics, but it I think that might be, sounds reasonable to me. Because I think like a lot of these schemes, they're leveraging classical, like properties of the classical scheme, and then they're kind of just asking, oh, I just need a few new tricks to do the quantum gates. So typically, a quantum homomorphic encryption scheme is, you know, not all of them, but the ones we know of so far are kind of built out of classical homomorphic encryption schemes. And for example, one common strategy is you can do all the Clifford's operations just by homomorphically, classically updating, you know, keys and such, and then you just need some new gadget to do like this like one of these non-Clifford gates. And because you're relying so much on the classical schemes, I think maybe it might be possible. But of course, it comes down to really like what the quantum attacks could be on such a, you know, if we're giving this quantum power, we need to assume that it, you know, it's a quantum adversary potentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
But interesting question for sure.
Thank you.
Maybe we can ask people who are following online. If you have a question, just speak up and we'll be able to hear you. Anyone? Any question? Online audience? No? I have a short question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the way that you turn this CHSH test into something that's sequential reminds me of communication complexity that you can use either entanglement or quantum communication in sequential quantum communication, right? But when you mentioned that, so it's kind of a, in my view, it's kind of an encrypted version of that, right? Mm-hmm. But what you mentioned is that actually Alice does the CHSH test and passes on to Bob, right? So they're not doing a sequential single qubit communication. They're doing actual the whole Bell test and then sending to Bob. It seems to be equivalent. Is there an equivalence there?
So Alice isn't doing the full Bell test. She's just doing like her part of it. But I think, so like the distinction is going to be in the case where like the provers are behaving as they should and honestly. So in that case, it is, of course, like we want it to be equivalent to this picture. But of course, we can't assume that they are. So we have to assume that they could be doing something where they're getting the Bell correlation somehow, but perhaps they're doing something more, you know, something weird and bizarre. Like in particular, you no longer have this fact that Bob's observables will be commuting with the measurements and circuit that Alice ran. So the correlations, I didn't write down what the correlations are that come out of this game, but they're, you know, they look at least quite different. They're much harder to work with than the ones that arise in the honest case.
I see, but they're not free to do a PR box, for example, and have these values which are higher than quantum, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, it's possible. We don't actually know that, you know, for instance, that they could generate such PR box or non-signaling correlations. That would actually be a requirement. So that's why we're trying to bound how much power these quantum provers have. It's potential that they could generate non-signaling correlations. And in fact, it's a really interesting point, and I didn't mention it, but if you naively do this, where you don't split it into two rounds, and you just encrypt questions under secret keys, then this is actually known to give them non-signaling correlations. And so they could win CHSH perfectly if you didn't enforce this round structure. And we don't quite, I mean, it's complicated why this is true, but even a classical prover could win CHSH with probability 1 if you're not careful. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you. So maybe it's time to move on to the next talk. Let's thank Connor again.